This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ah, you hear that? Refreshing, isn't it? The sound of Wall Street doing nothing at all. There was no bad news from the stock market today. Yeah, it helped that they had the day off. But, you know, not all the economic news is bad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Friday. It is the 21st of March. And I'm going to stipulate right at the top here that what we're talking about are incremental bits of news. You read a little bit here, you talk to somebody there, and without all the clamor from Wall Street in your ears, you can take a second to piece them all together. I'll give you just one to get things started. The dollar. It's not like 4 days a rally make, but remember that Monday the greenback closed at a record low against the euro, almost $1.60. Today, in very thin holiday trading, $1.54 to the single currency. Doesn't sound like much, but 6 cents in the world of foreign exchange is practically seismic. Marketplace's Bob Moon has more now on what else might be going right.
It wasn't just a good Friday on Wall Street because the markets took their usual holiday. Some leading analysts and economists say there's been a perceptible change for the better this week. They believe the Fed's bold actions, along with the Bush administration's more concerned tone, are giving the financial system the boost it needs.
I feel measurably better today than I did a week ago because policymakers are now fully engaged.
That's Mark Zandi at MoodysEconomy.com. He's hopeful the rescue has come just in time to prevent much more serious economic damage. And despite the recent drumbeat of worry over a recession, Zandi remains optimistic.
It isn't that bad yet. The economy is contracting, and I do expect it to contract further this spring into early summer. But everything's shaping up to suggest that this will be a relatively mild, short-lived downturn.
Indeed, it might as well be spring in the minds of some on Wall Street. Punk Ziegel analyst Dick Beauvais declared today the financial crisis is over, and he sees a once-in-a-generation opportunity to buy undervalued stocks.
I think the real estate situation by the second half of this year will have bottomed. There's a good chance manufacturing will be much stronger in the next 2 years in the United States than it's been over the past 5 years. Exports are rising. The vast majority of people still have their jobs and are likely to still have their jobs a year from now. This is not a massive, depressive situation.
Other experts point to low inflation, and the unemployment rate, as S&P chief economist David Weiss describes it, remains pretty darn good.
4.8% is a low unemployment rate. It's up from 4.4%, but historically, the average is 5.6%, so we're still doing better than average, and even with the recession, we think we're only going to get up to about average.
We says even reports the stock market has been battered lately have been exaggerated.
The beating is not very big relative to normal recession performance. In an average recession, the market drops about 36%. We've only dropped half as much so far.
The housing market bust is undeniable. Weiss points out, though, the Federal Reserve's interest rate cuts have helped make many mortgage resets more affordable and have even pushed rates low enough to make it worth refinancing many fixed-rate mortgages. But if the situation isn't all that bad, how is it the American people are so pessimistic? Economist Ken Maitland at Clearview Economics points to the drumbeat of scary news.
Well, I think I'm going to blame this on the media. Bad news seems to sell easier than good news.
And ever the optimist, Maitland says one thing he's learned during his years as an economist is that economies always recover. He says that's why he remains hopeful the country will see better economic times later this year. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Aloha Airlines said hello to Chapter 11 again today. I said again because it just got out of bankruptcy 2 years ago. It's news like that that's making corporate debt a really hard sell right now. Investors are asking why they ought to buy a company's bonds without knowing whether they're going to be able to back them up. Tough as the credit market is here, it's even trickier in China. Transparency is not all that much of a virtue there. Yet today we learned China's biggest bank, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, will be selling more than $1 billion worth of bonds backed by Chinese corporate loans. The buyers, it hopes, will be other Chinese banks. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The market for debt in the U.S. is pretty dead. So why does the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China think Chinese banks will want to buy the debt of Chinese companies? Georgetown finance professor James Angel says China isn't likely to face the same problems that sent the U.S. economy into a tailspin.
The financial markets in China are very different from the financial markets in the United States. Because of the extensive level of government controls, they are somewhat insulated from the dynamics of our financial markets.
And the troubles in the West make it an ideal time to offer investment in China, says Donald Strassheim with Roth Capital Partners. He expects there will be strong demand for these bonds around the world.
What better time for China to tap into the investment appetite than at a time when the American credit markets are in so much turmoil and disarray?
And Strassheim says, although the ICBC is a private bank, it's still very much a state-backed enterprise, and the government would not allow it to fail. But these are bonds backed by loans to Chinese companies, which aren't known for being open books. And it's hard to know if they will be able to pay back what they owe. Still, Georgetown's James Angel says investing in them is not as risky as it sounds.
There are real problems with reporting and transparency in China, but they are working hard to achieve world-class standards.
Angel points out that selling these securities is new terrain for China's banks. The ICBC sold its first asset-backed securities last year and raised about $500 million. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Passport Gate rippled through the political class in Washington today. Barack Obama wants Congress to look into why somebody at the State Department went poking around in the files of all three remaining presidential candidates. The Associated Press reported late this afternoon two of the contract workers in question were employed by a Virginia-based company called Stanley. The timing could not possibly have been more awkward. Earlier this week, Stanley signed a $570 million five-year contract to provide passport services to the government. Bean counters within the campaigns had other things to think about than politics. February finance reports were released last night. Obama raised more than $55 million. The campaign says 90% of that money came from folks who give in increments of $100 or less. Hillary Clinton raked in $35 million. The average donation there was $100, and 80% of the cash came in online. All of which got us to wondering whether the dominance of big donors in presidential politics might be coming to an end. We sent Marketplace's Steve Henn to find out.
The short answer?
No.
That's Steve Weissman at the Campaign Finance Institute. He says big donors still matter a lot.
You've got $344 million that have been given to candidates so far in 1,000 and over amounts.
But Joe Graff, a professor at American University, says recently both Democratic presidential candidates have figured out how to raise big money from average folks.
They've said to their activists on the street, thanks for your $20. Can you get 10 people to give $20 to?
Graff says small donors are more important than they've ever been before, in part because the net makes it so easy for these donors to build their own local fundraising networks.
People who can give $25 and $50, and I really believe that that's changed the tenor of things and will change things down the road.
A generation ago, the only way to reach small donors was by mail. That's how Karl Rove got his start, but it's expensive. In 2000, John McCain was the first presidential candidate to realize you could raise money more efficiently online, right after he beat George Bush in New Hampshire.
A couple million dollars came in 48 hours, and this sort of thing had never happened. People were just stunned by it.
Now McCain, the one-time leader, is a laggard. More than two-thirds of the $11 million he raised last month came from big money donors. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Good Friday didn't come a moment too soon for Wall Street. There was nothing happening on U.S. markets today, but other places were open. We'll have the details and the week that was when we do the numbers. The Chinese government's going to be turning its attention from Tibet to Taiwan this weekend. There are presidential elections Saturday in what Beijing regards as a renegade province. No matter who wins, it'll be a headache for the government on the mainland. Both the Taiwanese ruling party and the opposition there say they are the best choice to resist pressure from Beijing. Politics aside, though, the two economies are more tightly bound than ever. Marketplace's Scott Tong did a little demonstration to make the point.
If you turn off your laptop and explore its anatomy, you realize that the Made in China label is misleading.
The first thing you see here is the LCD panel.
Jimmy Hexter of the Beijing office of McKinsey Consultants does a little show and tell to illustrate.
The panels are made generally in Taiwan or Korea.
Taiwan. He says that a lot. Pop out the keyboard, and under the hood sits the motherboard.
Motherboards have been increasingly assembled by Taiwanese companies.
And on, Taiwan semiconductors, Taiwan network cards, Taiwan DRAM, whatever that is. It's a complex and tightly woven supply chain. But to oversimplify, the smarts come from Taiwan, the labor from China, and everyone profits. The Chinese workers who assemble these computers work for Taiwan-owned companies based in China. These Taiwanese firms dominate the industry.
If you go to the campuses that some of these companies have built in China, you're really seeing hundreds of millions of high-tech products, whether it's PCs, whether it's notebooks, whether it's mobile phones, whatever it is, to an order of magnitude that's almost unimaginable.
The Taiwan-run firms then sell their products to companies like Dell, HP, IBM, etc., who slap on their logos and make them instantly, quote, American. In the production of electronics, this interweaving between mainland China and Taiwan evolved quickly. Political scientist Shelley Rieger of Davidson College says just 20 years ago, the two sides had no business links. In fact, China was just emerging from its Soviet-style past.
China, for so many decades, had no market economy. No one learned how to do business in international markets. But in the late 1980s, when the rest of the world was shunning the Chinese economy, right after the Tiananmen incident, Taiwanese investors rushed in.
But they came indirectly. Airplanes couldn't fly straight to China. They still can't, under a Cold War barrier still on the Taiwan books. But slowly, those walls are coming down. Both Taiwanese presidential candidates pledged to allow direct flights, plus more cross-straits investment. It's meant to boost the economy and appeal to the business community. Taiwanese securities executive Ling Xianbing says it's working.
If we want to open more to the global economy, we need to throw away the ideologies and take a more open attitude towards the mainland. That's best for Taiwan.
Shelley Rieger says it's also best for Beijing, which sees itself as Taiwan's motherland.
The Chinese government believes that having a good, tight economic relationship with Taiwan advances their political interests.
And for some Taiwanese, there's the rub. If their businesses drift too close to China, the island could lose its perceived identity. Still, Rieger thinks if both sides manage things well, they can have it all. Economic integration and political truce. Kind of like sharing an office, but sleeping in separate beds. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson on the road this week. Mr. Johnson, you picked quite a week, huh?
Oh, boy. It's a great week to have behind us, and it's a great week to say that we're still standing.
Well, let's. How do you want to do this? Do you want to do it back to front or front to back? You want to start with Bear Stearns, or do you want to get to yesterday?
Well, the whole thing began so frightening. It was just remarkable to see, a mighty firm like Bear Stearns, in essence, fold. I mean, $2 a share in stock is a token amount. But what we saw right then was that the Federal Reserve had more in its arsenal, more than just cutting interest rates, because, boy, that sure hadn't worked. But to go in and walk in and prop up that firm and then simultaneously change the rules so that you wouldn't have another Bear Stearns.
Let me ask you how close you think we really were. I mean, were you looking into the jaws of really bad stuff here?
Yeah. I mean, it could have been. It could have been. You always wonder if the system works. And I think there was some real doubt about this Federal Reserve, whether they really understood what was going on and could do what was necessary. And we may look back on this as that defining moment for Bernanke in particular, that 1987 was for Alan Greenspan. I mean, there was a lot of doubt about Greenspan at the time. I actually called him a malleable political beast that was put in there by Reagan and had no business being there because I love Paul Volcker.
So do you think now Bernanke has kind of made his bones with the financial world?
You can't quite close the door yet, but I sure think so, because look at what's happened. All of a sudden, there's some increased confidence in a lot of these investment firms, and boy, you sure need that. You absolutely need that. Then simultaneously, we had this problem of this enormous commodity bubble, which was killing the U.S. dollar and dragging money away from the financial markets. And what he did, I think, in one fell swoop, what's happened this week is a lot of that has just been taken care of. I mean, yesterday was just remarkable.
Let me ask you one quick thing before I let you go, David. I want to go back to maybe a month, 6 weeks ago, and we were talking about trust and how really nobody trusts anybody out there. Are we still in that place where you can't trust anybody, or has that changed now with what happened this week?
I think it's altered a little bit. The real key was getting to some of these investment banks to go up and actually borrow money, because nobody wanted to do it.
Right.
It was going to be seen as a sign of weakness and that they were going to be the next Bear Stearns. And now I gather over $28 billion has been borrowed. We know the big names, Goldman Sachs, Lehman, Morgan Stanley, others presumably have come in. And they're all still standing. And, we're not out of the woods yet, but I'm telling you, it's a much better long weekend than we could have had. And if we can go through a few more days here and not have any just monumental negative surprises, then I think we've turned the corner.
All righty. David Johnson, he is actually in the woods someplace in Tennessee. Mr. Johnson, we'll see you later.
All right. Have a great weekend.
You too. Coming up, best wishes for a new bridal business.
We are here as sisters, as hermanas, and we're here saying, you know what, girl, we're rooting for you. And not only that, but we're going to put our resources there.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were closed in the U.S. and in much of the world today for Good Friday, but brokers were plenty and busy in Asia and the Middle East. Asian stocks rose on speculation that U.S. investors won't lose their heads in Wall Street's roller coaster ride. Japan's Nikkei gained 1.8% overnight. South Korea's Kospi Index rose 1.4% as plunging commodity prices, as Johnson was just talking about, eased fears of global inflation. Taiwan's index climbed 2.3% on speculation that tomorrow's presidential election will bolster ties with China. Shares edged up in Malaysia and Thailand, too. A mixed bag in mainland China. The Shanghai Index fell 0.2%. Market mammoth PetroChina fell 4% as commodities tumbled, but the smaller Shenzhen Index rose 1.4%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for February. Let the games begin. The Olympic flame lighting ceremony takes place in Greece. The Beijing Games Green Torch will burn non-polluting propane as it makes its journey around the world. The torch itself is recyclable. And after a weekend dying and hunting Easter eggs, egg salad is on the menu. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. New York Senator Charles Schumer's no fan of President Bush. He's never made a secret of that. But earlier this week, he let loose with a really low blow. Senator Schumer said the president reminds him of Herbert Hoover. Commentator and economic historian Amity Schles takes a look at the parallels between past and present.
Herbert Hoover. It's about the meanest thing you can call a politician. Hoover was the president who promised prosperity and oversaw financial disaster instead. But Hoover wasn't all bad. And contrary to myth, he was an activist president. History students count Hoover's policies on their fingers. Hoover talked about confidence when people were starving. Hoover created the Reconstruction Finance Corp to help home builders, families, and farmers. Hoover increased protectionism by signing the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, even though he had lived in London and knew better. Hoover raised taxes in a downturn. Even English majors know you don't do that. And finally, Hoover got the monetary wrong. He saw inflation where there was deflation. Whoops. So who's replicating which Hoover policy? When it comes to the confidence chatter, Bush is the one acting in the Hoover tradition. The president gave a big speech about optimism Friday, even as Bear Stearns disintegrated. Maybe he should have been more frank. On housing, again, Bush is a Hoover. He created FHA Secure to help challenge borrowers refinance. But there's nothing wrong with that in itself. On trade, it's the Democrats who are the Herberts. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama posture to see who can repeal NAFTA first, even though they know better. On taxes, likewise, the Democrats seem the more Hooverish. Obama has a Social Security reform that would significantly increase marginal tax rates for top earners, just as Hoover did. But what about monetary policy? From the gold price to the oil price to the price of coffee, evidence of inflation proliferates. Yet Democrats, Republicans, and the Federal Reserve seem to be looking for deflation. Monetary policy is hard these days, just as it was for Hoover. So it's not right to label just one politician Hoover, especially given the current economic challenges. There's enough Hoover to go around for all of us.
Amity Schles is Senior Fellow for Economic History at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can relate to us online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. March isn't really a big month for weddings, but the matrimony industry is already in full swing. Bridal expos are really hot right now. More gowns and decorations and cakes than you can shake a stick at. Wedding magazines are getting bigger by the month, too. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Caitlin Carroll has this story of a publisher who wants to print part of the $69 billion bridal business on Espanol.
Miriam Gomez and Domingo Sanchez met online. Then they met in person and fell in love. A few years later, Domingo popped the question. Miriam said yes, without hesitation, and hit the bridal magazines hard.
I went to the market and the drugstore probably every day with my mom. And even before I got engaged, I think it's just something we all tend to collect after the year, throughout the years.
Both families will spend big for the big day, probably around $30,000. Miriam will wear a long veil like her Cuban grandmother's, and she and her fiancé have hired a DJ who can play salsa and boleros music. Miriam says she looked through dozens of magazines to get ideas.
Ceremony Magazine was one of my favorite magazines. Also, Brides Magazines, InStyle. That's where we found, a lot of our vendors.
Lillian De La Torre wants her new magazine to be at the top of that stack. It's called Bodas USA or Weddings. It's the first American bridal magazine written entirely in Spanish. De La Torre says many Hispanic couples like Miriam and Domingo are willing to spend big bucks on their weddings. And they're also folding in more traditions.
We have a saying in our culture that, you know, tiras la casa por la ventana. That means you just throw everything out the window, because when it comes to weddings, people go in debt. And Latinos are not an exception.
At the Bodas USA launch party, Latina models sashay down the catwalk wearing big skirts and long veils. The staff wanders around nervous as new brides. For De La Torre, this day is 7 years in the making. She invested $100,000 of her own money and took out a loan. She also got support from the National Hispanic Business Women's Association.
It's a family affair. I'll put it that way.
President Teresa Mercado Cota.
We are here as sisters, as hermanas, you know, and we're here saying, you know what, girl, we're rooting for you. And not only that, but we're going to put our resources there.
There is fertile ground. A recent study shows the buying power of young U.S. Hispanic consumers growing 14 times faster than the traditional market. Advertisers want a piece of that. Total ad spending in Spanish language media jumped to almost $3 billion in the first part of last year. Bridal magazines are only a sliver of that market. And Bodas will be competing for advertisers, not only with Hispanic magazines, but mainstream ones too. Marketing expert Juan Torno.
I think that they have some potential. I do believe it's going to be a hard sell for the traditional advertisers, for the big agencies, for the big PR firms. They're going to say, you know what, we're reaching them elsewhere.
De La Torre is starting small. She's sending out 30,000 copies twice a year to California, New York, and Miami. She's banking on brides' buying fever. Most brides-to-be pick up everything on the rack. Miriam and her mom smile as they flip through Bodas' first issue.
I think that if I was to see a magazine that, you know, was targeted, I would be more inclined to buying that because, for example, in flipping through the pages, I see women that look like me and, you know, I can see their families and it's, you know, it's similar.
De La Torre's hoping that kind of connection will encourage brides and Bodas to tie the knot. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Caitlin took some pictures at the Bodas launch party. If you're getting married soon or if you just want to check them out, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to snap us back to a more pessimistic place than where we started the day. The gang at Standard & Poor's was working today despite the market holiday. They weighed in on Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers by cutting the outlook for the brokerage's debt ratings. Didn't cut the ratings themselves, just said they're keeping an eye on them in the face of what could be greater losses yet to come. Lower credit ratings, of course, would make borrowing more expensive, not anything that anybody needs right about now. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed today for the Good Friday holiday. They're back to work on Monday at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Yore. Coming up on Monday, Coming to America carries some unexpected surprises.
The toilet is very, it freaked me out, you know. I thought, I'll flush it. I got up, I put my zip up, and then it automatically went. I was scared for first time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.